electrodynamics, how to quantize the electromagnetic field. And so we arrived at the conclusion that one has to include not only the physical transverse polarized photons. I mean, there are two possible polarizations of a photon, which we choose to be circular. But then we should also include unphysical longitudinal photons, so which may appear only in the intermediate states. So if you have a photon moving with momentum p, so there can be circular polarized photons with polarization vector epsilon 1, then can be circular polarized waves with opposite polarization. So these are physical transverse electromagnetic waves. And then there are two unphysical longitudinal polarizations, epsilon 3 and epsilon 4. So epsilon 3 is just p mu. And epsilon 4 is longitudinal polarization. So these are unphysical longitudinal polarizations. And so we should associate with each of this polarization creation and annihilation operators with the canonical commutation relations. And so only those so physical states are only created with creation and annihilation operators of transversely polarized photons. So these are correspond to physical states. So the reason why we need to distinguish those is, as we saw, can be traced to the gauge invariants of the Maxwell's equations. But in the intermediate states, anything can appear. And in particular, when we sum over all polarizations, so then the completeness equation for polarization vectors is mu of p star epsilon mu s of p reads like that. So they form a complete basis, well, by definition, and so they satisfy the completeness condition. Yes. Virtual particles. So later, when we will do perturbation theory, as usual, in perturbation theory, we need to take matrix elements of some operator. And so in this matrix elements, we will need to take all the states, all oscillators, but external states that correspond to physical particles are only created by physical oscillators. Okay, so we know how to contest electromagnetic field, and now electromagnetic field interacts with charges, and then we saw that we know how to quantize charge fields, electrons and positrons. So we now can understand how to couple electromagnetism to, yes? Minus sign? Yes, thank you. There is a minus sign. So when we can couple electromagnetism to electrons and positrons. So the resulting quantum field theory, which is grandmother of all quantum field theories, is called quantum electrodynamics and will be the major focus of the rest of the course. So to understand how to couple electrons and positrons to the electromagnetic field, we can first understand how to couple electromagnetic field to an external classical current. So suppose that there is some charge distribution that is given, and we want to study the response of the electromagnetic fields. So we first couple to external electric current, which we'll call J mu. So this is just a given classical function for a vector. So how to introduce, how to insert this in the Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field? Well, to motivate how we should couple it to electromagnetism, let's consider the case where J mu is equal to rho and then zero. So it's just a static distribution of charges. So of course, charges if we have an electromagnetic field also, then static charges, they perceive the electromagnetic potential, and their electrostatic energy is just equal to minus, or let me see, plus E times integral d3x phi of x rho of x, right? So E is electric charge. So phi is the electrostatic potential and rho is the density. This is just a basic first year physics formula. So if you write this in components of the four vectors, this will be equal to what? To A0 times J0. So, of course, it's easy to generalize, and the interaction energy for arbitrary configuration of charges that also contain currents will be equal to A mu G mu. So this is basically, this is the only Lorentz invariant generalization of this, right? So if you want to make coupling to, of currents to magnetic to vector potential Lorentz invariant, we should write down this expression. So the Lagrangian is minus the Hamiltonian, so the Lagrangian of interaction is therefore simply minus E A mu times J mu. So if we add this term to the Lagrangian, the equations of motion acquire the right hand side, and they have this form, so the current appears in the correct place. Yes. This line. Well, if we set J to be static, so without currents, then this reduces to that expression. And then, okay, it's the only Lorentz invariant thing one can possibly write. It was just a motivation how to couple the electric current to electromagnetic fields. Or if you wish, we can start from this formula, which you, I guess, you're familiar with. And then the way to arrive at it is just to add the linear term to the Lagrangian, and from the Lagrangian equation. So motion one derives this equation. Right, but then in the Dirac theory, we got a very particular, so we know how to write down the current. So so the current was given by this expression. We just derived it from the Noether theorem. And consequently, we can write the Lagrangian that describes coupled electromagnetic fields and the Dirac field that describes electrons and positrons. And so this is will be the Lagrangian of QED. So this is the Lagrangian of QED, and let me say a few words about conventions. So by convention, the current so defined corresponds to electrons having charge plus one. So usually electron is considered to be negatively charged, and here this is this corresponds to E being equal to minus absolute value of electric charge. So E is negative. And this is the electric charge of an electron. So then the coupling will be indeed charge, okay, numerical value of charge, then the number density of electrons times the electromagnetic potential. Now, what are the symmetries of this theory? Well, first of all, it's Lorentz invariant, but then also in the Dirac theory, the Lagrangian was invariant under phase transformations, and this invariance doesn't disappear. So this Lagrangian is invariant under rotation of the Dirac field by a phase. On the other hand, the Maxwell theory was invariant under gradient transformations. And it turns out that if these gradient transformations are properly normalized together with these transformations, they become a symmetry of the Lagrangian such that alpha now can be an arbitrary function of x. So in the Dirac theory, alpha was a constant parameter. Here it can depend on x. So this is local invariance. Well, to see this, I mean, it's not immediately clear that this Lagrangian is invariant. And, well, one. One might actually wonder, why don't we try to check if the just the Dirac Lagrangian was invariant under these transformations with the local parameter alpha. And one can immediately see that it is not. Because, okay, so for. So if alpha is independent of x, then, okay, this is just, it produces a phase factor with the sign plus for psi with the sign minus for psi bar. So any expression that contains equal number of psi and psi bars is invariant. However, when alpha depends on x, derivatives that are present in the Dirac Lagrangian will also act on alpha. And so you can see that d alpha, d psi, transforms in the wrong way. So it becomes the derivative of psi multiplied by a phase factor. So we can pull out the phase factor, but then there is an extra term that is proportional to the derivative of alpha, right? And so if you substitute this in the Dirac Lagrangian without the electromagnetic field, this extra term will not cancel. So just the Dirac Lagrangian is not invariant. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a little confused. It doesn't have x dependence, but what's the d mu?
Oh, then it's zero.
Oh,
so. I mean, just so let's just concentrate on this part of the Lagrangian that is contains only the Dirac fields. And so then we knew that it was invariant with constant alpha. With non-constant alpha, it is not. Now, what happens here is that this extra term gets canceled by the transformation of A. So you see that separately, the f mu nu square term was invariant under local transformations. But then in this term, A appears without derivatives. And so it will just shift by the gradient of alpha. So this term will not be invariant. But together, these two terms, I mean, the the transformation compensates each other. A nice way to see it is to introduce the covariant derivative. So, which means that we should really combine this derivative term and the A term together, because their transformations are tied together. So to see this, we can introduce a covariant derivative. Or sometimes it's called the long derivative. So this is a derivative with the vector potential added to d mu. Now the claim is that that the covariant derivative of psi transforms again in a very simple way. So that d mu psi goes just to e to the I alpha d mu psi. So the way it happens is that, okay, so when we pull out the exponential from through the derivative, we get this gradient of alpha term. But on the other hand, A also transforms under gauge transformations. And the transformation of A contains the gradient with the opposite sign. So it compensates the transformation of the psi, of the derivative part of the transformation of psi. So the Lagrangian of QED then can be written in a very compact form if you combine the coupling of electromagnetic field to fermions into a covariant derivative. So now in this form, the Lagrangian is manifestly gauge invariant, because you see the covariant derivative transforms in such a way that it only produces a phase, which cancels against the opposite phase from the transformation of psi bar. So in this sense, electromagnetic field arises as a compensating field to ensure the gauge invariance of the Dirac Lagrangian. So one way to see why we need a mu is to say that this is a compensating field. So in other words, we could have started just with the Dirac Lagrangian. Suppose that we don't know anything about electromagnetism, and then required that it is invariant under local gauge transformations. So to ensure that, we would have needed to introduce a compensating field that we can call A mu. And so we would have written this Lagrangian. And this can be seen to be the simplest gauge invariant quadratic action for A. So the Lagrangian, the whole science of electrodynamics, in some sense, is a consequence of gauge invariance, or can be derived from requesting gauge invariance of the Dirac equation. Okay, so do you have any questions at this point? Well, then we continue to the next part of the course. And so far we at this point we reached some important stage in this in quantum field theory. Namely, we now know how to quantize free fields. So we consider three examples: electromagnetic field, scalar field, and the Dirac field. And in all cases, the Lagrangian was quadratic, and the fields equations of motion were linear. We solved them in terms of oscillator, in terms of Fourier expansion, and then oscillators are just free modes of the fields. So QED is the first example where we have terms that are not really quadratic. So you see that this term contains three type of fields. So the equations of motion will not be linear. If you substitute J in this form in the Maxwell's equations, the right-hand side will be quadratic in the Dirac fields. So the way of solving this theory by expanding on oscillators will not work. So we cannot really diagonalize the Hamiltonian here using oscillators. And this is because this theory is interacting. So this term, of course, describes interaction of electrons and positrons with the electromagnetic field. And in general, we don't know how to solve interacting field theories. So there is no way to diagonalize Hamiltonian in general. And one has to resort to some approximate methods. So the one method that is very general and that we will consider here is perturbation theory. So we will assume that the coupling constant is small. And then, well, just take into account this interactions as small corrections to the to free fields. So we will study next perturbation theory. And so, well, first of all, we want to understand whether this will give a good approximation to quantities that we want to calculate. And this, of course, depends on whether the interactions are weak or small. For instance, in QED, so first of all, in the units that we are using, electric charge is dimensionless. So to see this, we can notice that, well, electric charge determines an interaction force between, say, positive and negative static charges. So So if we consider, say, the Coulomb potential between two charges, it will be equal to E squared over 4 pi r. So the left-hand side has dimension 1 in units of energy. So this is just the energy of interaction two charges. Now, 1 over r also has dimension 1. This is because we chose units in such a way that distances has inverse dimension of momentum. Momentum has the same dimension as energy. So this already has the same dimension as the left-hand side. Therefore, the coefficient must be dimensionless. Which means that the electric charge is just a constant, or I mean, it's some number. Usually, one introduces the combination that is just the ratio that stands here, which is c squared divided by 4 pi. And let me also write this in normal units. So this is 4 pi h bar c. And this is called fine structure constant. And is equal to 1 over 137 point something. So it's called fine structure because it determines the splitting of some energy levels in the hydrogen atom, which, I mean, the splitting is very small. And so this determines the fine structure of the hydrogen spectrum. And you see why the splitting is small. This number is very, very little. So it's 1 over 137. It's a very small number. So this means that electromagnetic interactions indeed are sufficiently weak. And so perturbation theory should give reasonably accurate predictions. Moreover, these predictions are, I mean, the corrections are so small, and usually they are not important. But there are very famous quantities which can be calculated using QD perturbation theory. One of them is the anomalous magnetic moment of electron, which is known. This is, I think, one of the most accurately known quantities in physics. It's known to, I forgot, 11 or 10 digits. And the corrections to it are described by perturbation theory in QED. And they're all calculable. And so this is one of the quantities that can be computed using the methods that we'll study. So the idea of perturbation theory is very simple. So if you have some physical quantity B, which can be, I don't know, potential of interaction between electron and positron, anomalous magnetic moment of electron, some scattering probability, anything, which is a function of the coupling constant. And then we just expand it in power series in alpha. Now, so first of all, in the Lagrangian, electric charge enters linearly. So one may wonder why the expansion goes in powers of the square of electric charge. Well, there isn't a symmetry with respect to changing sign of A. So if we interchange electrons and positrons, the equations will not change much, but this will only change the sign of phase. So since this is a symmetry of the theory, the physical quantities can only depend on E squared, not on even powers of E. So perturbation theory will be a set of rules to compute these coefficients B. So we want to derive rules to compute Bn. And in principle, we'll derive rules that allow one to compute Bn at any order. But in practice, calculations become more and more complicated when we go to higher and higher orders of perturbation theory. So usually one can compute few first coefficients. And since alpha is very small, then first few orders will give reasonable approximation. So this is the philosophy of perturbation theory. Now, of course, we can apply it to other field theories. And as another example, we'll consider interacting scalar theory. Which is obtained from the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian by adding a quartic term. So we can consider the Lagrangian where we add a term that is quartic in the fields. Which again describes interactions between Klein-Gordon particles. Then it has some coupling constant lambda. Which we will assume to be small. And then again, we can expand in power series in lambda. Before deriving this set of rules how to compute the coefficients of this expansion, let me discuss what is the accuracy of perturbation theory and what is the real parameter of expansion. And that can be done in very general terms by dimensional analysis. So as usual, if you have some problem in physics, you can get an idea of how the solution looks like by just counting dimensions. And in field theory is not an exception. So you can more or less understand what the physics will be just by looking at the dimensions of the parameters that enter the problem. So in particular, in perturbation theory, the dimensional analysis is very important because this is an approximate method, and we want to understand what the accuracy will be. So suppose that we have a generic interacting quantum field theory, so the Lagrangian of which can be written as the free Lagrangian, which will be quadratic in fields. And so this can be either Klein-Gordon or Maxwell or the Dirac Lagrangian or their combination. And so we know how to quantize it. And then we add terms that we want to consider as perturbations. And in principle, we can add arbitrary number of them with potentially arbitrary coefficients. But since the Lagrangian is, well, is really what it is the Lagrangian density, so it should, which we'll later integrate over x to get the action. So the Lagrangian density should be local. It should depend on fields evaluated at one particular space-time point and their derivatives. So so here, Ji are coupling constants. That determine the strength of the interaction, and OI are local operators. So locality here is very important. So so local means that they depend on fields and their derivatives at this, at the same space-time point. So as examples, we may consider the interaction Lagrangian in QED. So then operator will be this one, and the coupling constant is minus E. In the 5-4 theory, so the operator is pi to the 4, and the coupling constant is minus lambda over 4 factorial. And in principle, one can write arbitrary complicated combinations of fields, their derivatives, et cetera, et cetera. The only requirement is that these operators must be scalar so that they don't break Lorentz invariants. But otherwise, they can be arbitrary. Now, suppose that we consider some we want to calculate some physical quantity B, and then we want to expand it in the coupling constants. So we will treat these interactions as small perturbations on top of free fields. And so let's consider. So let's consider the simplest example when we have some quantity that. So in general, the quantity will depend on kinematic variables and coupling constants. So kinematic variables can be, you know, external momentum of particles, or say we want to compute a static potential between two charges, then it will also depend on the distance between charges. So anyway, so let us consider a quantity. That depends on just one kinematic variable that we'll call energy and one coupling constant G. So this is some physical observable. E is well, let's call it energy. which need not be literally the energy. So, for instance, this can be inverse of the distance, or something else with the dimension of energy. So we will assume that the dimension of this quantity is equal to 1. Okay. Just by dimensional analysis, and then suppose that the dimension of quantity that we want to calculate is equal to A. Well, then without any calculations, the natural assumption would be that B scales with E as the E to the A, right? B is proportional E. And then we want to expand B in power series in the coupling constant G. And in this expansion we can we can immediately figure out what. So we want to know what is really the expansion parameter, and just on dimensional grounds, we can see that the expansion parameter will be some combination of G and energy their dimensionless ratio. So for that, we need to know what is the dimension of the coupling. So let's assume that the dimension of coupling is equal to nu. Then the ratio G divided by E to the nu is dimensionless. And so this will be really the expansion parameter. So we can write that B will be equal to E to the A, and then some coefficients B and bar G divided by E to the nu to the power n. So these coefficients, they are dimensionless. And since we don't have any parameters in our disposal, this will be just numbers. And so without doing any computation, typically, numbers come out to be for the one, right, from a random computation. Yes. Just because this is by dimensional counting. So this has the same dimension. So without any further assumptions, it's most natural for it to be proportional to E to the A. So if there were no other parameters in the problem, no coupling, for instance, then we would know for sure that the coefficient of proportionality is a number. Yes. There is a power of alpha here. So for instance, if B scales has dimension 2, then the ratio of B divided by E squared will be, dimensionless. So it must be a number. So B should scale as E to the power, which is a dimension. Yes. Am I clear?
Maybe it's a little bit confusing, but E in the dimension of E is 1 means that its mass in terms of power. Yeah?
Yes.
A little bit confusing. Yes. 1 means that its mass in terms of power.
Okay. Yes.
Why did we not
Yes, that's right. So this is there is another assumption that goes in here is that we can do perturbation theory, which means that we can really expand. So we assume from the very beginning that we can expand B in power series, which start from the zero order term, which is non-interacting theory. So the rest we assume to be small corrections. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to write this. And then the rest is dimensional analysis. So, right, so let me return to your question. So, in the system of units that we chose, there is only one dimensional scale, and that can be, that we chose to be mass or energy. So, we measure it in electron volts, and so any quantity that we can encounter will have definite dimension in these units. So it will scale as electron volts to some power. So that's why we can write that any quantity will, if there is only energy, I mean, if the only variable in the problem is energy, then the answer will be given by dimensional analysis times some number. Okay, now when we have a coupling in the game, there will be a power series. And again, we understand what is the expansion parameter. This is the dimensionless ratio of G to the energy to the power that is given by the dimension of the coupling. So I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't. I should give some example to. Otherwise, this discussion looks a bit abstract. So let us consider the following calculation. So suppose we have electron and positron. Electron. So suppose we have a static electron, and then there is a positron that. Or say a beam of positrons that is colliding with this electron. And then, so they interact and produce the pair of oppositely charged muons. So what is the probability of this process? So let us make several assumptions. So first of all, let's assume that the energy of this incoming electron, or incoming positron, is much larger than all masses involved in the problem. So it's much larger than the mass of the electrons and even mass of the muons. And then we can just neglect these masses and consider all the particles to be massless. So I claim that the probability is measured by a quantity that has the dimension of area. So this is called the cross section. The reason is that, okay, so suppose that electron and positron were some, I mean, rigid spheres like in billiard. So then the probability of their collision will be determined by their sizes. So they can either, I mean, collide or not collide depending on whether their cross sections intersect or not, right? So depending on their trajectories. So this is in the classical picture. The probability would be measured by just the cross section of electron seen by the positron. So now it turns out that this classical picture it continues into quantum mechanics. So the probability is always determined by the effective cross section. Uh, So this is basically the probability of positron to produce an electron muon pair on the electron. Later we will give a more formal definition. Now the only important thing for us is that the probability has the dimension which is minus 2 in the units of energy. Because area has the dimension of distance squared, distance has the dimension of inverse momentum or inverse energy, so the cross-section will have dimension of inverse energy squared. So we can immediately tell that the cross-section will be equal to 1 over a squared, and then some function of alpha, that we can expand in perturbative series. So the series will start from the first order, because if the coupling constant is zero, the electron will not interact at all with the positron. So the series will start with the first term. And then they will go in powers of alpha, because alpha is dimensionless, so there is no further dependence on energy here. So indeed, at very large energies, the cross-section of any QD process depends on energy as 1 over E squared. This is dimensional analysis. And then in principle, one can calculate these coefficients, but they are numerical constants of order 1. So we immediately figure out what is the general form of the answer. And moreover, having calculated the leading order, we have an idea of what order of corrections we may expect. So the next correction will be proportional to alpha. So it will be, well, smaller than 1%, because alpha is 1/137. So we know that the corrections will be very, very small. So then returning to the general formula, we see that the parameter of expansion might depend also on energy if the coupling constant is dimensionful. So here this is not the case, because alpha is dimensionless. But in principle, we can have the case where nu is non-zero. Yes?
Why do we have a perturbation series in alpha and alpha?
The odd powers of E cannot appear by charge conjugation invariance. So everything should depend on E through E squared. If you change the sign of E in the Lagrangian, physics will not change, essentially. So this would be equivalent to interchanging electron with the positron. And the cross-section is obviously the same if we send electron and then scatter on the positron. So therefore, it should be a function of E squared. Instead of E squared, we can use alpha. Yes? Didn't quite understand the question, sorry.
Well, if we use, except of the E itself, the absolute value. The absolute value of charge.
Oh, absolute value of charge. Sure. But that cannot appear. It's non-analytic in E, so. We expand in power series we have a function that is a function of E, right? And so we can expand it in power series. If absolute value appears, this means that there's some non-elasticity at zero, which is not the case.
That's one of the assumptions we implicitly make when we're writing B as a power series. It's an analytic function.
That's right, which is, by the way, it's always wrong, but I shouldn't have said that. Perturbation theory. So usually these power series are divergent, but nevertheless, truncating them at few lowest orders always works.
Yeah, well, whole course on this called mathematical physics by Carl Benberg. So how to make sense of perturbation theory.
Okay, so you will learn it. Yes.
Sorry, why do we start the series at one? N equals one.
Because if so, if the leading term would be independent of alpha, then by setting the coupling constant to zero, we would get a non-zero answer. But this doesn't make sense. So this, when the interaction is absent, there will be, I mean, this process will not be possible. They would not interact. Okay, so I'll probably stop here. So in the next lecture, we will understand, so we will learn how to compute this dimension of the coupling constant, because it's obviously very important. It tells us what is the effective expansion parameter in perturbative series. So obviously the most important part is the sign of nu. So if nu is zero, then the coupling constant is a number. So it's either small or big. Just two possibilities. Now, if nu is positive, then basically we can always make the expansion parameter small by going to very high energies. But in real life, we are interested in low energies. So this means that perturbation theory in such case is not a good approximation. Where nu is negative, then the expansion is good at low energies. And then problems start at when we go to energies comparable to the inverse coupling constant. So all these three cases appear in physics, and we'll discuss what they correspond to in quantum field theory. Thank you. That's all for today.